Now, in 1976, Ronald Reagan lost the Republican presidential primary to Gerald Ford, the party's sitting president. He was dismissed as too ideological and maybe even too old to be president. 8 years later, he swept the national election for his second term as president of the United States, winning all but one state. Our next guest has been chronicling what changed in American culture and politics during that time. Over a series of four books, he's documented the rise of conservatism here in America. He's here now to share his latest about the years leading up to Reagan's election. Rick Perlstein is a journalist, columnist, and author of the new book, Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here, Rob. You know, driving around as a very nerdy high school student in Milwaukee when growing up, I would listen to WHAD and I would always, you know, dream of being one of the authors who was interviewed, you and Terry Gross on WUWM. So, you know, it's always a pleasure coming back to the Ideas Network.
Well, you've reached the pinnacle now. There's nowhere to go there but down from here, I guess.
Well, every year, needed or not.
Well, you pack a lot into this new book, but I want to go even wider and talk about your project going from kind of the mid-1960s after Barry Goldwater got beaten in the presidential election up to the 1980s. Talk about this long-term project to trace the rise of conservatism.
Yeah, I've been working on this since 1997, so I've finished it up with this book. It's 23 years. It actually starts in the late 1950s when it's pretty much conventional wisdom that conservatism is not really relevant in American politics, that we're a center-left nation, that we're becoming a nation in which, you know, the government takes care of more and more basic functions like, you know, we're now familiar with in Northern and Western Europe, that America is on its way to kind of ending its racial ordeal. And that people like Barry Goldwater, who was the guy who ended up winning the Republican nomination in 1964, were utter irrelevancies. So the first book I wrote about this was called Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. And it's about how Goldwater won that nomination, and it ends with his landslide loss against Lyndon Johnson. And the last page of the book is all these pundits saying that the Republican Party is literally dead as a part of American political life unless they purge the conservatives, which is pretty much what happens at the beginning of this book after Jimmy Carter wins in 1976. And in between, I wrote a book called Nixonland, which was about how Richard Nixon really revitalized the appeal of the American right by weaponizing the resentments and fears of white middle class Americans. And then the book in between is called The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. And it again finds the Republican Party being counted down and out because of Watergate and the Watergate class of Democratic congressmen that brought Congress to a 2-to-1 Democratic majority. You see a pattern here. And that was about Ronald Reagan's first run for president in 1976. And then this book starts right where that left off, with one pundit saying that Ronald Reagan has about as much chance of becoming a presidential contender as Richard Nixon.
And you trace this concerted effort to take the Goldwater ideology in many ways and make it dominant ultimately in the Republican Party, and then to take that Republican Party and win elections. And there's one phrase that keeps, I guess, echoing through this book of one of the organizers of this effort: we organize discontent. Can you break that phrase down for us and talk about how that played out?
So Barry Goldwater, you know, loses in this terrible landslide, and he's the guy who just absolutely says exactly what's on his mind and exactly what he wants to do for the country. So when he writes this book called Conscience of a Conservative, which sells millions of copies, but mostly only to conservatives, he says he's for ending all agriculture subsidies. He's for ending the progressive income tax. He says that Brown versus the Board of Education is not based on sound law. He says we have to be willing to risk a nuclear war against the Soviet Union, and that the only reason we don't is because a craven fear of death has crept into the American the American public. And, you know, conservatives love this, and they basically take over the party from the ground up, but in a very sort of conspiratorial way. It's not like a majority of Republicans want these kind of views. They use the rules, and they pretty much assume that the public, once they hear these ideas, will somehow fall in love with them. And of course, it's an utter flop. The big difference in the people who are organizing as conservatives in Jimmy Carter's presidency, they call themselves the New Right, is they realize that they can take the American public's much more broad-based fear and anxiety over the social changes of the 1960s. Their fears about things like gay rights, their fears about things like feminism, their fears about things like crime and law and order in the form of gun control legislation, which of course they oppose. If they can take the public exactly where they are, even to stoke up those resentments, stoke up those fears, which they do with great aplomb, they can kind of seduce them into voting for candidates who do the stuff Barry Goldwater wanted to do, but have a much more broad mass appeal. And it works really well, to the extent that not only does Ronald Reagan win the presidency in a landslide in 1980, he does so with a preponderance of what are then called Reagan Democrats, who are former Democratic voters. Often they're union members. They're from places like Milwaukee. And they're people who are terrified of, their daughters getting pregnant or their sons saying they're gay and all that sort of stuff.
Talking to Rick Perlstein about his new book, Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. And Rick, you trace all these different groups, social groups and organizations that hadn't necessarily been overt political players in the 70s. Okay. They emerged as key election shaping forces, including evangelical Christianity, which Jimmy Carter did okay with evangelical Christians. Then what happened?
Yeah, it's a really interesting and ironic story. So you got to understand that evangelical Christians, fundamentalist Christians, basically categories that overlap. They might have been very culturally conservative in the way they lived their lives and the way they saw their world. But one thing they generally were not were political activists or even sometimes voters. There's a line in Romans enjoining Christians to cast their eyes above and not care about worldly things. And that was basically taken as an injunction to not get yourself messed up with politics, right? That's for Caesar, right? It's not the Lord's. And one result of all these social changes is that all these discontents begin to take political form because preachers, first of all, they completely give up something that was very dominant among conservative Christianity previous to this period, which was contention over theology, right? So so Southern Baptists decide they're not going to be mad at Pentecostals. Pentecostals decide they're not going to be mad at Mormons. They'll even work with Jews because the task is seen as so monumental to beat back the satanic forces of liberalism. So you have a bunch of very charismatic television preachers and a bunch of political organizers who are kind of working behind the scenes who are doing things like, for example, leading initiative campaigns on ballots around the country to repeal gay rights laws. You have Christians who are saying that the government doesn't have a right to regulate their schools. And the watershed for this is in 1979, when Jimmy Carter's IRS commissioner tightens up the rules for private schools that have basically sprung up in profusion since the 1960s because parents want to protect their kids from what they see as the snares of liberalism. They tighten the rules to prove that your school is not segregating. And it's not necessarily that these schools don't want to have Black students. In fact, I document that a lot of them went through extraordinary efforts to recruit Black students. But for example, in the South, a lot of these same preachers in the 1950s have been segregationist leaders, so Blacks didn't want to have anything to do with them. You know, they were very proud of the struggle to have been able to enter integrated public schools. But these preachers absolutely freak out at the idea that the government is telling them to run what they consider as adjuncts of their ministries and their churches. And that really is the watershed moment in which any kind of compunctions that preachers have of basically turning their churches into precinct organizations washes away. And a lot of that is financial, because what the IRS seems to be threatening is their tax exemptions. And without their tax exemptions, they're not going to be able to make their payrolls and all the rest. So I take the reader to this absolutely galvanizing, absolutely insane administrative hearing with the IRS in which preacher after preacher stands up and says that they're willing to go to jail, they're willing to die, to fight for their right, you know, not to fill out government forms and that sort of thing. And of course, by the next year, these preachers are all organizing their congregations to vote for Ronald Reagan, even though 4 years before, Jimmy Carter was really the first evangelical to run for president. But by that time, he's thrown his lot in with, for example, the movement to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, which is one of the galvanizing discontents that conservatives are organizing around. So Jimmy Carter had once been this evangelical hero, but he was a very old-fashioned evangelical in that he refused to base his legislating based on his understanding of scripture. It certainly informed his moral judgment, but the people who were saying that, for example, gay rights are unbiblical, you know, Jimmy Carter was a mild supporter of gay rights, that sort of thing.
Talking to Rick Perlstein, author of several books on the conservative movement in the United States. We're talking about the new one, Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Reagan-era conservatism? What do you remember about the transition from President Carter to President Reagan? Were you politically engaged at the time? Were you inspired to get into politics because of Ronald Reagan? Positively or negatively, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the rise of Ronald Reagan and the forces that shaped modern American conservative politics with Rick Perlstein, author of several books on the topic. His newest is called Reaganland. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the Reagan era? Did his win in 1980, if you were around then, surprise you in a good way, in a bad way? How did conservatism in America change with the presidency of Ronald Reagan? Call it with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rick, we were just talking about a change in evangelical Christian voters. Another big change, I hadn't realized this till I read it in your book, the first endorsement of a presidential candidate by the National Rifle Association, Ronald Reagan, in 1980. They underwent a big change in direction in the time period you cover in your book.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. The National Rifle Association began after the Civil War by former Civil War officers who were afraid that the marksmanship of American men was not up to snuff. So, you know, the next time a war came, you know, we wouldn't be able to shoot straight. And it really had nothing to do with gun control at first. And all the way through most of the 20th century, it was basically what you joined if you wanted to, you know, be a hunter and you wanted to learn about guns. And, you know, the American Rifleman magazine was mostly about outdoorsmen and, you know, target shooting. It was only with the rise in crime in the late 1960s and things like urban riots that you began to see a faction of the National Rifle Association organizing against gun control, whereas the people who were running the organization were pretty much supportive of things like mild gun control, banning what were then called Saturday night specials, which were, you know, cheap handguns that were believed to be preponderantly used in the commission of crimes. And you begin to see a faction organizing sedulously underground to take over the organization and turn it into a political machine for opposing all gun control. And the guy who's the head of this faction is this crazy, colorful guy named Harlan Carter, whose nickname is Bullethead. It was later revealed that he had been convicted of murdering a young Mexican immigrant that his family had believed had stealed poultry or something like that. The conviction was overturned on a technicality, but this guy was, you know, like Charlton Heston, you know, avant la lettre. And what they did was at the 1977 meeting, they used all sorts of procedural tricks and parliamentary tricks to undermine the leaders of the organization. And at 2 a.m., after, you know, all these kind of points of order and all the different things you do to take over a meeting, the smoke clears and these guys are in charge and they fire the entire staff. And they basically say, if you're interested in anything other than getting all the gun control laws off the books. You shouldn't be in our organization. And that becomes one of the many struts of this new right-wing coalition. And one of the people who had always been advocating for this was Ronald Reagan. So Ronald Reagan, after he was governor of California, basically he made a living by lecturing and doing a newspaper column and also doing a daily radio broadcast. And one of the radio broadcasts he gave in 1975 that I listened to in the archives, he said something that would become very familiar in the decades to come, which is that when you outlaw guns, the only people to have guns are outlaws. So this idea that this was all about disarming the good guys, and you know, he would talk about, you know, the reason we have the Second Amendment is to protect ourselves from a tyrannical central government. And this kind of macho kind of John Wayne mentality becomes part of the Republican coalition, such that by 1980, yes, just like you say, the National Rifle Association for the first time says, yeah, we got a dog in this fight. You know, Ronald Reagan is for us. Jimmy Carter is against us. That was yet one more of these discontents that this new right political faction was organizing in order to unhorse liberalism in American politics.
Let's bring on a caller. 642-1234. Sarah is with us in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hey, Rob. Well, for some reason, this is funny to me. I just remember being 16 and Reagan and I guess what was Carter up for re-election that year. And then and I just really didn't like Reagan. I can't remember exactly why, but I'm sure it was for environmental things. And there was a candidate here in Illinois named John Anderson, who I just really liked. And he was kind of a Republican, but he was into like conserving gas. So I was really for him. But then in 84, when Reagan was reelected, that was the first time I got a little bit involved. And I remember I wrote letters to the editor and I was like talking to people. And then I was just so depressed. And my issues would be like Central America and then environment again.
Yes.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. Rick, I think it's fair to say Reagan probably got a lot of people involved in politics for him or against him.
Absolutely. He was a very polarizing figure. He certainly got a rise out of John Anderson from Rockford, Illinois. He's a really interesting figure because he had actually been an early adapter, shall we say, of Christian right politics. When he came to Congress in the 1960s, he actually introduced an amendment to the Constitution to make Christianity the official language of the United States. But he just kind of became more and more left-wing. He was a Republican, but he was very disgusted with the Vietnam War. He was very excited about the civil rights movement. And by 1968, he's a liberal. And they say every 2 years, you can tell when it's election time in Rockford, Illinois, because John Anderson cuts his hair. Right. Because in Washington, he was a liberal. But, you know, this was making him more and more alienated from the conservatives in Rockford, Illinois. But he was a very prominent Republican. He was the House whip and he was beloved by reporters. He was quite brilliant. He was quite eloquent. And in 1978, he got the political scare of his life because one of these early preachers, a guy named Lyons, challenges him for his nomination for reelection for his 20th term. And John Anderson almost loses. And he realized that the Republican Party is being taken over by forces he hardly recognizes in the form of these right-wing preachers and all the rest. And so he runs for president. And in 1980, there's a very crowded field. You have about a dozen candidates at the beginning because Jimmy Carter seems to be such a weak president. But only one of them, John Anderson, represents what is actually a very long and distinguished strain of Republican liberalism. And he just is handed defeat after defeat. And then he decides that the public is so dissatisfied with both choices on the ballot for 1980 that maybe he can run as an independent. So he does manage to get on the ballot in all 50 states. And he Sarah's right. His main campaign promise was a 50-cent gas tax, you know, to encourage preservation with a kind of 50% kind of rebate of the payroll tax. And he was very popular among kind of media elites. Walter Cronkite fell in love with him. He almost sounds like a partisan on the CBS Evening News. And there's once an article in the New Republic that Walter Cronkite had agreed to become John Anderson's running mate. But anyway, long story short, John Anderson gets about 8% of the vote, and a lot of that vote comes from Jimmy Carter, because John Anderson, by election day, is even more disgusted with Jimmy Carter than he is for Ronald Reagan. And one place he wins is New York State. Ronald Reagan wins is New York State. And that's almost certainly because John Anderson took so many votes from Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just 30 seconds or so left. Rick, where do you go from here? This has been a long project for you with these multiple books on this long, evolving story.
I think I'm going to write a shorter book, kind of concanting the wisdom I've derived about, you know, how the Republican Party operates and how liberals like me can defeat it in future elections.
And just briefly, so much of the landscape we take for granted now, it evolved in this time period that you just wrapped up in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and that's when I was growing up. You know, I talk about in the book, I talk about Star Wars, I talk about Superman, all these movies in which the public was kind of longing for these narratives of innocence, good guys and bad guys, instead of the kind of moral ambiguities of the earlier 70s.
Rick, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Rob. Bye-bye.
Rick Perlstein is a journalist, columnist, and author of several books on American conservatism. His latest book, the last one in this series, is called Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. Still time for you to share your thoughts and your memories of that time if you're around for that era in American politics. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR.